Ladies and gentlemen, Professor von Klitzing has given us a wonderful introduction into some of the things that are going on in heterostructure physics today. And I would want to wind the clock backwards a little bit and talk about some of the way how all of this got started. The title of my talk has a very simple origin. It was 21 years ago that I was invited to give a talk in Japan, and I was told, well, something on heterostructures. And when you're given such a free rein, then the fundamental rule, it is better to be wrong than to be dull. And so I deliberately came up with the title, Heterostructures for Everything, Device Principle of the 1980s. And I decided it would be a good idea to recycle that first part of the title, and therefore I chose this one as the title for my talk today. Let me briefly review what we mean by heterostructures. This is sort of an introductory course into heterostructures, if you wish. And, well, heterostructures are semiconductor structures that contain more than one semiconductor, in which the transition between the different semiconductors plays a functional role in the operation of the device. And one can summarize this somewhat loosely by saying the interface is the device, or the transition region is the device. And, well, what are, before I get into the physics of why this is interesting from a physics perspective, let us say a few words about what materials we are talking about so it isn't too abstract. So let us look at the central portion of the periodic table. And in the middle, of course, there is silicon. And as we all know, silicon is sort of the backbone of electronics, was and is today. Underneath is germanium, which got all of this started. And then there is the rest of those elements that will play an important role in my story. One of the important ideas is any element of column 3 and any element of column 5 can be combined into what we call a 3-5 compounds, of which the most important one or the most widely used one is gallium arsenide. But all of these 12 possibilities are being used for one application or another in today's heterostructure electronics. But that is only the beginning. You are not restricted to those 12 discrete combinations. For example, you can combine aluminum and gallium in a certain ratio in an alloy called aluminum-gallium arsenide. So that means you actually have a continuum of different materials. And in heterostructures, what we are then doing, well, you can do the same thing also on column 2 and column 6. So we have a rich set of materials with which we can work. And the idea that you now can vary the composition with position throughout the device, will then lead to heterostructures. We are not completely free in what we want to combine. An important consideration is that we have to have at least approximate lattice matching. What I mean by this one is that the interatomic distances on the two sides of a transition or at the two ends of a gradient have to be approximately the same, because otherwise we are developing huge strains in the structure, and that leads then to defects. And I have yet to find anybody who has found any virtue in any of those defects. So we are restricted somewhat to at least approximate lattice matching. And those of us who are in this business tend to call this one the map of the world. It is actually the map before Columbus, or before the nitrides, I should say. But it gives you a good idea of typical material system with which we are working. The most interesting one is the gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide. This system, I call this the great crystallographic accident of the 20th century. This system the two materials have essentially the same lattice constant. So we can, along this line, form alloys. And in fact, germanium is down there near the bottom on exactly the same line. But the combination between germanium and gallium arsenide, for a variety of reasons, is not a promising combination. This, of course, plays a very important role, because if you want to grow heterostructures with a high degree of perfection, one thing you need is a substrate. And so one of the reasons for the dominance of the system is the fact that we are having available high perfection substrates on which then other heterostructures can get grown. Another semiconductor that is readily available is indium phosphide. Well, there is nothing in the way of a binary compound that is lattice matched to indium phosphide, but we can make alloys along this entire line. For example, if you can go all the way from up here at that particular point, we are lattice matched to indium phosphide. A very widely used system is the, down here, is the gallium indium arsenide lattice match. And in fact, this entire vertical line is being used. And here is a personal friend of mine, the 6.1 angstrom group, indium arsenide, gallium antimonide, aluminum antimonide, which involves some recent research of my own, in fact, which is widely used in some recent research topics. The lattice match there is not perfect. But when you are talking about very, very short dimensions, as in superlattices, for example, then the thinner the layers, the larger is the lattice match that you can tolerate before something happens. So a lattice match of, lattice mismatch of under 1%, is readily usable in the kind of systems we want to talk about. Now, what is the underlying physics? Why is this interesting? Well, let me pretend I were a teacher teaching my device physics class, and one of the messages that I try to get across very, very early and very repeatedly is the importance of energy band diagrams. And so I have something which, for those of you who can read the fine print, Cromer's lemma of proven ignorance. If, in discussing a semiconductor problem, you cannot draw an energy band diagram, then you don't know what you're talking about. And any good lemma has a corollary. And the corollary to Cromer's lemma is the lemma of induced ignorance. If you can but don't, then your audience won't know what you're talking about. And so, obviously, I'm setting the stage for talking about energy band diagrams. And it is really very, very simple. Nowhere are those lemmas more true than in the discussion of heterostructures. And as I said, it is really very, very simple. Let us start out with a piece of silicon, completely homogeneous, and let us assume we are applying an electric field to this piece of silicon. Then the energy band diagram simply consists of two parallel lines. The vertical coordinate is the energy, and the vertical separation between the two lines, that is simply the energy gap of silicon, 1.1 eV. In other words, that's the energy that you need to lift an electron from the valence band to the conduction band. So this is the pair production energy if you're a high energy person. And once you have an electron up there, there's, of course, this electron sees an electric force, and this electric force drives it downhill. And the slope of this line is of course, the slope in the potential energy, and the force is simply given by the slope of the line. If you have a hole down there, a hole is a missing electron state. A hole is like a bubble in water. It rises to the top, and so you have exactly the same force on the hole as you have on the electron, only that it's in the opposite direction. So that's it. Now let us assume you're having a heterostructure, and for simplicity, conceptually, let us look at the case that the transition is not a discontinuous one, but is a continuous one. In other words, the composition changes with position, and that means the energy gap changes with position, and in this case, the two lines will no longer be parallel. And for example, it would be possible, we assume it would be possible, to have a scenario where there is no slope in the conduction band, but there is a slope in the valence band. If the idea is correct that it's the slope in the bands that determines the force, then this means that in this particular case, there will be no force on the electrons, but there will be a force in the holes. So we clearly have separated the idea of force from the idea of an electric field. This does not mean that there is zero electric field. There is an electric field there. It's just that the electrons do not care what the electric field is. They only see the band edge slope. They only see a quasi-electric field, and the electrons see a different one from the holes. And you can carry this game one step further. You can have a situation where, I have to line this up, otherwise it doesn't look right, where you have a force on electron and holes that goes in the same direction. And I think you recognize immediately that this is something that is fundamentally impossible to achieve with pure electric fields alone. And in fact, again, there is, of course, an electric field. But whatever, if I would ask you, which direction at that point, whatever answer you will give me, I will claim, no, you get, it's wrong, it's the other way around. But of course, I'm guessing just as much as you are. And so this is then the central idea underlying all heterostructures. I call this quasi-electric fields. And let me quote a sentence from a 1957 paper of mine. These quasi-electric fields present a new degree of freedom for the device designer, which enables him, in those days all device designers were male, enables him to obtain effects with the quasi-electric forces that are basically impossible to obtain using only real electric fields. That then was, at least for me, the point of departure some 40-odd years ago. And it is always interesting, you remember our panel discussion yesterday, it is always interesting for anybody who has any sense of history, how did this concept come up? And Professor von Klitzing gave us an idea yesterday that he himself was led to his fundamental discovery by actually studying something extraordinarily practical. Well, I also started from something extraordinarily practical. I was working in a laboratory where I decided to concern myself with the question of what were the speed limitations of those new transistors. Transistors were invented 1948 or thereabouts, and so these were the early days of the junction transistors. And these things were hideously slow. And so one of the ideas that I was thinking about, well, if it were possible to introduce an electric field into the base region of the transistor to speed up the injected carriers, the minority carriers, from the emitter side to the base side, that would presumably speed up the device. And of course it does. It is not the only, it's not the only consideration that determines speed, but it was the one on which I concentrated. And so one of the ideas that I had was to build a transistor, and that is not the exact copy of the 1957 paper that has got redrawn recently. I had the idea that to build a transistor where the energy gap in the base was sloped, where the doping was sufficiently heavy for N-type doping. This is obviously an NPN transistor, for those of you who know this one. Most of you are familiar with PNT transistors. It is very easy to convert an NPN transistor into a P transistor, at least on a projector. In the laboratory, that causes some difficulties. Anyway, those early transistors we were dealing with were PNP transistors, so you would inject holes here, and the holes would then be speeded up towards the collector. And when I told this to my friends, you see, I was a theorist at that group. I was what is called the house theorist. I was, in fact, not allowed to touch any equipment. When I told this to my technology friends, they only shook their heads and says, there's no way we can build this one. And one gentleman, Dr. Hanlein, came up with the idea, well, the most I could possibly do would be to build a transistor had a different semiconductor for the emitter from the collector. We all realized immediately that this would destroy of this quasi-electric field. But then I realized that this has benefits of its own. So let us show here a modified Venn diagram. We have now lopped off this particular triangle here. Now the base has a uniform energy gap, but the energy gap of the emitter is now larger than the base. And that has important consequences of its own, namely any electrons that want to climb out of the base region into the emitter would have to overcome a larger energy gap and a larger barrier than electrons being injected into the base. And for those of you who are familiar with the theory of the bipolar transistor, those of you know that the wrong current, the back injection into the emitter, is one of the big performance limiting factors in the transistor. That is true in silicon transistors even today. And by increasing the energy gap, the step height, you are now decreasing the back injection current exponentially. This goes like E to the energy gap over KT. And anybody who knows something about the properties of the exponential function realizes that this is fabulously effective. A 2/10 of an EV energy gap difference is easily achieved. 2/10 of an EV exponentially gives you a factor of 3,000. Now, this reduction in back injection current is so large that you actually do not want to utilize all of it. What you want to do instead is to increase the doping in the base region by a factor of 3,000. And that totally changes the performance characteristic of the transistor. And so it is this kind of heterostructure bipolar transistor developed gradually. Oh, starting only in the 70s, because the technology did become gradually available in the 70s. And both the graded gap and the wide gap emitter version are being used, the best, the highest performance transistors of this kind, probably use a combination of both. And the name of the game is basically speed. These are simply by far the fastest bipolar transistors that can be built. They are going into the hundreds of gigahertz now. And they're also used at much lower frequencies commercially. Those of you who have cell phones may or may not realize that in the transmitter stage of the cell phone, the transistor driving the antenna is probably, not certainly, but probably, a heterostructure bipolar transistor based on one of the 3-5 compound material systems. The heterostructure bipolar transistor is not the only device, the only transistor-type device, that benefits from heterostructures. Chronologically, much later, followed field effect transistors based on heterostructures. And the key idea here, the most important part here, is shown in this particular diagram. It refers to an idea by Horst Stürmer, who had available to himself, this was now during the 70s, at that time, molecular beam epitaxy that Professor Klitzing has so beautifully described had come on stream. And molecular beam epitaxy made it possible for us not only to build graded structure, but also to build abrupt interfaces. And the abrupt interfaces now made possible a whole range of new applications that graded interfaces would not make possible. And Horst Stürmer had the following idea. Let us assume he had a heterostructure with a discontinuous conduction band offset now. So this is a quasi-electric potential step. And that we would put the donors that contribute the electrons only on the higher energy side. Well, those electrons will then spill over the barrier. Effectively, this quasi-electric potential separates them from their donors. But once they are down here, they no longer see the quasi-electric potential. They only see the Coulomb attraction by the residual donors. So they get pulled towards the interface, and now you're forming a two-dimensional electron gas. Professor Klitzing showed us a very similar energy band diagram. Normally, you put a little spacer in here. The idea of that spacer is to remove the donors even from the vicinity of the interface. And, well, what's so good about it? Well, what is good about it is now those electrons are separated from the donors, spatially separated. That means they see far, far less scattering by the Coulomb potential of the disordered donor setup. And so we're getting much higher mobilities. And this shows up in field effect transistors under the name HEMTs, high electron mobility transistors. But it also has a tremendous impact on fundamental physics because the fractional quantum Hall effect was really based on structures that utilized this principle, the high mobility and the high degree of perfection that became possible with molecular beam epitaxy contribute to this step. I simply want to mention this here because it does fit into the overall story, but I, of course, did not make any contributions to that one, although at least one gentleman who made a very important contribution to the theories is sitting here in the second row, and I think you all know who I'm talking about. Well, let me spend a good part of the rest of my time on the optoelectronics end of things. Again, this was one of those things I stumbled into by accident. Remember, I said yesterday at the panel discussion, the one thing that didn't influence me was a profound knowledge of the subject matter. Well, I was working in industry at the time, and in 1962, the first semiconductor lasers had been demonstrated. They were basically gallium arsenide p-n junctions, which you biased for. We gave a forward bias with a very large pulse, and there you saw laser action. I was still in those days amazed that semiconductors would actually be capable of emitting light. And I didn't follow this particularly, but a colleague of mine took a great interest in the subject matter, and in March of 63, he gave an absolutely superb research colloquium at our company. It was Varian Associates in the Bay Area, where he described it had been done, and he also pointed out that all of these things worked only at low temperatures under the pulse operation, and being in industry, of course, we had a director of research who was acutely aware that this was not terribly useful, and so he asked Saul Miller, that was the name of the colleague, well, what are the chances of getting this to operate continuously at room temperature? And Saul had read the literature very carefully and said, no, this has been looked at, and he named some experts who must remain nameless, this is fundamentally impossible. And so let me give you a brief review of why this was supposedly fundamentally impossible, it illustrates the power of the heterostructure principle. Let us assume you're drawing, again, a band diagram of a gallium arsenide p-n junction that we just happen to have forward biased to precisely the level that the conduction band and the valence band are flat. So in other words, basically we are giving it a forward bias of the order of the energy gap. Well, electrons then spill over here, holes spill, move to the other side. There will be a region where you have both electrons and holes present, and light will be emitted. But you will not get a laser this way, or at least not very easily, because in order to get a laser, you actually need a population inversion. You need a higher occupation probability of this state than you have at this state. And so in terms of Fermi levels, you need a quasi-Fermi level inside the conduction band and a whole quasi-Fermi level inside the valence band. And the first thing that this calls for is, of course, that you have very heavy doping, that the electron concentration in the n-type contact and the hole concentration in the p-type contact themselves had to be degenerate. Well, you can, of course, increase the forward bias, but the whole point is if you increase the forward bias, the electrons escape essentially immediately to the right, the holes escape to the left, and it simply is not possible to get continuous operation at room temperature out of the structures. And so, anyway... Saul Miller had just barely finished when I simply said, well, that's a pile of nonsense. Actually, I didn't use the word nonsense. You probably can imagine what I said. All you have to do is put a wider energy gap on the outside. So now suddenly the electrons can no longer escape, the holes can no longer escape. This still does not readily make for laser action until you increase the bias voltage a little bit. And then you get this energy band diagram. You have effectively created a bucket for the electrons. You can now accumulate in here far more electrons than you have in the electrodes themselves, by a big factor. Same for the holes. And now population inversion suddenly becomes very simple. And so this was the idea for the double heterostructure laser. At least my own history was one where basically the idea was conceived, the possibility was realized within 1 minute after having been told that there was a problem. So knowing what the problems are can be useful, but you do not have to know the problem for a long time in advance. For those of you who Professor Klitzing mentioned that patents were issued, and of course I said yesterday that Professor Alferov and I filed patents within 1 week of each other. For those of you who know how the front page of patents looks, see, filed August 63, issued 67. I should perhaps add, expired 85, which meant that it expired before anything useful could be done with it. Well, in the laboratory, of course, it had been used, but there were no practical applications, no commercial applications yet. Well, today, these things are, of course, everywhere. Not only is this pointer obviously an example of a laser, but this goes far beyond layers. So this really has become the backbone of a whole technology, starting with true laser applications. I think the first commercial application was in compact disc players. Basically, the whole compact disc technology would not exist if it were not for that itsy-bitsy little device inside the double heterostructure laser that reads the disc. Now, some of you might consider this an advantage if this technology didn't exist, but that doesn't make it go away. I think the majority of us actually enjoy this technology. But it doesn't just work for fiber optics communication. I'm sure many of you realize that long-distance telephone, or for that matter, internet traffic, no longer goes over copper cables. These things just do not have enough bandwidth. Many of the cities in the Western world, the roads have been ripped up, and cable and glass fibers have been put into the ground. Well, the signal travels along those glass fibers in the form of optical pulses. But we are not in any way restricted to lasers. This whole principle also is a very important principle for ordinary light-emitting diodes. And so here I have one that is blue, that is a double heterostructure system, where the active layer is gallium nitride and the barriers are gallium aluminum nitride. And what color you get depends, of course, on what semiconductor you use. And so here is a green. This is an appendix to a keychain, and I think I could go on with this story for a while to illustrate applications, but I think I've made my message. Well, at that point, something very sad happened, and I alluded to this one in the panel discussion yesterday. I was told, well, this is all very interesting, but there are not possibly going to be any applications. Well, we did file this patent. There was also a paper sent to Applied Physics Letters, but they rejected it. So I was told to send it to the proceedings of the IEEE. They would publish anything. And yes, they did, but there nobody read it. But the real killer was that I was told, as I said, that I was told there were not going to be any practical applications. And so let me today review in English what I said in German yesterday. I call this Cromer's lemma. I like lemmas, obviously. Cromer's lemma of new technology, the principal applications of any sufficiently new and innovative technology have always been and will be applications created by this technology. And I believe in this one very, very strongly. And I, of course, believe in it because I have some personal experience with this one. But I'm by no means unique. This has happened to probably hundreds of other people, and it will continue to happen. But we should keep that in mind, that we should look at new science and technology, not from the point of view of what can it do for existing applications, but what might it be able to do for the future. Along the same line, I would like to quote a statement by David Merman in Physics Today last year. I am awaiting the day when people remember the fact that discovery does not work by deciding what you want and then discovering it. And this is a beautiful way of formulating it. I couldn't have done it that well. But with this call for strategic research that we often hear, well, David gave here the perfect answer. He was delighted when he heard that I actually was quoting him in my Nobel lecture, where I showed that same view graph. This is sort of how I'm close to the end of how far I wanted to carry my talk. It is always better to stop when people say, hey, he's already finished. Let me simply add one more item that I personally find very useful in looking at heterostructures. You see, I've never talked about how these bands line up in an abrupt structure. In a continuous structure, this is not an important consideration because there the Fermi level determines pretty much how they line up. But in an abrupt structure, you must make a decision. And one of the reasons why my early band diagrams never showed any abrupt structures was because I didn't know what the band offsets were. But today we have some pretty good ideas, and it's useful to classify band offsets by three different classes. One is, of course, I call this the straddling type, here where the narrower of the two gaps falls inside of the wider gap. That is the case where the force, if you view this as a graded transition, where the quasi-electric force in both on the holes and on the electrons goes to the same side. And that is, of course, the structure that you want to have for quantum wells. This combination also exists. And it is not as widely used for practical devices, but it can be used. For example, you can have the following phenomenon. Electrons are sitting here. Holes are sitting here. You have what is called a spatially indirect situation. But the electrons can, of course, tunnel into the barrier. The holes can tunnel in the barrier. So the wave functions will still overlap. And so you can have now light emission at a wavelength where the quantum energy, the photon energy, is less than the energy gap of both materials. And that has useful applications. And then you find my personal friend. This is the most exciting system of them all from a scientist's perspective. Not from a, I haven't found any practical uses for it yet, where you have what I call a broken gap, where the conduction band on one side drops below the valence band on the other side, so electrons can freely move from one side to the other. Well, on this side, they have a positive effective mass. On this side, they have a negative effective mass. And you can now play some very interesting games in physics. But my, ladies and gentlemen, my time is up. And so on this note, let me close my talk. Thank you very much.